Good afternoon. My name is Diane Herriot, and as the Parliamentary Librarian, it is my pleasure to welcome you all to today's Parliamentary Lecture, which is kindly being recorded for us by Broadcasting Services and will be loaded up on the internet later today. The Parliamentary Lecture Series enables us to bring distinguished speakers to the Library to present on topics of interest to Senators and Members. And certainly today's lecture deals with just such a topic, the important and almost perennial issue of aged care reform. Today's speaker is Professor Hal Kindig, Chief Investigator on the ALRC Centre of Excellence in Population Ageing and Research and Head of the Ageing Work and Health Research Unit at the University of Sydney. Professor Kindig is a gerontologist and sociologist with more than 200 publications on health, social and policy issues, on the health, social and policy aspects of ageing. He's a member of the Australian Academy of Social Sciences and a distinguished fellow of the Australian Association of Gerontology. His current research and policy work is focused on ageing baby boomers, determinants of healthy ageing, aged care and health services, and international comparison. Professor Kindig has kindly agreed to talk to us for about 40 minutes and to take some questions afterwards. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Diane, for the introduction and further to the Parliamentary Library for inviting me to speak. And in particular to Rebecca De Boer here, who's been so helpful and who's very knowledgeable about aged care and provide further advice. Can I begin by asking each of you to reflect on the older people who you've known? Those through to their deaths? Think about what you would like for aged care. And all these abstracts and policies are about real people. Now, let me give you two instances of the real people for me. One is my mother, who died in Los Angeles at a retirement home less than a year ago with dementia, not of dementia, and she was still her person to the very end. The other story is, I remember when I walk into this building, goes back to the mid-1980s, when I was giving some testimony to a Senate inquiry into retirement incomes. I invited my parents, who happened to be visiting, along to this event. And I then realized that I was saying things, my recommendation of my beliefs and my research, to the Senate committee, which were at odds with my own parents who were sitting in the audience. And at the end, after I made a case, I would tell you privately what the case was later. My parents came up from one side, and Flo Bjelke-Petersen came up from the other side. I had to connect the two. And what did I say? I said nothing. And Flo Bjelke-Petersen looked at me, she looked at these two older people from the U.S., and she said, "I don't agree with everything he says, but he must be a fine son." How's that for a political skill? But in the end, of course, it's about people. And our job, your job in policy, and my job in advice and knowledge, is about enabling the best decisions and to happen for the older people and the carers. Okay. That's who I am. And before going on, can I just say that we are really at an auspicious time. We've been waiting for something like the Productivity Commission's report for a long time. Back in 1984, I was reminded earlier, there was the so-called McClay report, in a home or at home, which were the exact same issues. And maybe this time, with a lot of consensus, with a lot of will behind it, intelligence, it can happen. I'm very hopeful that we're right on the edge of implementing. When I say implement, that means the beginning, though it's probably going to be at least a 10-year move ahead. Okay, now my talk is going to be in these overview. I'll tell a story along the way to these overheads, but you'll have access to the overheads. So at least we'll get some main take-home messages, a bit about what got us to the Productivity Commission report, the government's response, and some ideas for moving ahead. And importantly, this part at the bottom, for the government and constituency views, hear it directly from them. Go to their websites And my views, I should say, are evidence-based as much as I can, and they draw on research, observation, and peak body involvement since the 1980s, including about 15 years living in this town. Okay, so let's start with some main take-home messages for us. We have to make most of the reforms right now, an ongoing bipartisan commitment. And you must have that ongoing commitment. And there are ideological edges, political edges, this way or that way. But there's a main message here for older people, and we have a government and national responsibility to move ahead. I think the main theme behind all the specifics is this one about moving beyond controlling centralized programs, things like HAC and residential care programs, all of which have been very useful to move us ahead. But we have to know what we're aiming for, which is a regional management of consumer-directed care. That's what we're aiming for. The job is complicated by the economic restraint and unmet need. The restraints are easily seen now. The unmet need is harder to see right now, and especially for those who cannot afford it on their own. And what happens is when we ration care, it means that those who are most in need and often with least power don't get enough or maybe miss out altogether. And we have a very optimistic message. We can do it better, more efficiently, through person-centered and whole-of-government approaches. This is the new way of thinking, the new way to move us ahead for the next decade or two. Okay, so let me start with where we are now. Just a quick run through where we are now. You know the story. If you want to explain something, the answer is, well, it all started back then. And because each new development, especially spending programs from government, set expectations in the public, and they set interest groups for the continuation of those programs that on the one hand are moving us ahead, but on the other hand mean we're always locked into the past. So we have to be aware of that. This long-term trend from the way we deliver care, from providers to funders and now to consumers, I almost put a question mark there. It's an open discussion now. We might even say people. Long-term trend from residential to community in its provision, and more so in the way of thinking about care. The story here really began long before Leo McClay's report, In a Home or at Home, 1984, was this mid-1980s aged care reform strategy. And it's important for us to remember what the politics were back then about why it actually happened. There are two driving forces. One was the Commonwealth was very frightened about the blowout in nursing home expenditure. They brought some of the best people, who I would name, from around, not here now, in the world, over to manage these programs, to implement them, to deal with that cost blowout. The other, a little bit below the surface, but more powerful in the longer term influence, was the growth of the women's movement. We have a certain Governor General now who was involved with that back then. And what I didn't appreciate at the time was how the women's movement then had middle-aged women who were very concerned about their parents. They were concerned about the pressures on them and their children, for that matter, in terms of staying in the workforce and providing good care. What are we going to do about it? And I would say those were the two driving forces. The fiscal imperative of the Commonwealth government, along with an underlying social movement. And I think we're at that sort of point, again, right now. We had the HAC program, the residential care program. The whole idea of a program means you set the objectives, you then mobilize the resources and the guidelines, etc., to deliver that program, then you see it works. Previously, we had spending programs. The money just went out. We've had a couple of goes at this, and we have to remember some lessons about why things didn't work earlier. John Howard in 1996 tried to put in some reforms, and can I say that those foundered when it was perceived as attacking home sweet home. And that we had Warren Hogan's excellent review about how to bring a market approach to providing aged care. I was actually on one of those committees. I've been on many of these committees along the way. And Warren's excellent program, it all made sense. didn't go anywhere. It was saying we should open up supply of aged care onto the market and not just have the privileged supply that's through the current providers. So now we have a new go at it, the Productivity Commission, I think it's a wonderful opportunity. It's been very carefully and well put together, but we have to realize it's dealing with the same structural issues that we have been partly but not fully addressing over these, 20, 25 years. And it's going to take time. And we should have started yesterday. Okay. Big picture things. This is more me as a researcher, but what I know from looking at older people and listening to them. We have to provide for changes, what we would call through the trajectory of later life. We have to look beyond a simple care need to the other interrelated social and economic issues. The importance of upstream action. That is that just as children develop, older people in varying ways are stable or they decline or whatever. So things can be done to maintain independence, and we've got increasing evidence health behaviors and support can enable people to stay independent for much longer. Client-centered, consumer-led, these words, we have to emphasize the improvability of aging experiences. It's not all downhill slide, and we have to focus not on just on the people, but the systems. And that's what we're going to talk about, the systems that enable the good care and the importance of the whole of government integration. These are really tough asks. For any of you who've been on an IDC, interdepartmental committee, trying to get something done, that tough business of across functions, across so on. Okay. The current context, we have a solid base of 25 years of developing community care. We all know the weaknesses of the intergovernmental gridlocks, centralized control and flexible programs, blame game, and so on. The hard reforms have been postponed, one could say probably, for 25 years now. We have opportunities with the COAG reforms. Some are wavering a little bit, some are a little bit uncertain, but we've had a really big start with COAG. And the most important is the bottom line here. Practitioners, older people, and carers can do it. They can do it on the ground if supported by policies, structures, and funding. They're the ones that do it. Okay. We've achieved a lot. We know much more about how to provide quality care. We're moving, and again, against resistance, rebalancing from residential toward more community. We're having more of a needs and a rights approach now. Actually, we actually had that back in the mid-80s as part of, I would say, a government move to influence providers to think about term consumers. And we're seeing more of that, as we'll hear in a minute. The cost shifting remains acute. The state government committees I've sat on, Commonwealth program development, so much of it's not about what an older person needs or wants. It's about who pays. We've got to get away from that. We need integration and coordination, a long ways to go. Resources and workforce, well, yes. Okay, do we have a new playing field? I think we do to a degree. That half basically is moving to the Commonwealth. We have these new structures for primary care, national preventative health, the new local health and hospital networks. So it's all encouraging, but it's early days of encouragement. And the question, are we on the way to a single funder and hence removing the blame game? And that funder would be the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth's the one that has the dollars. May I say the state governments are particularly impoverished now. And the next question is, can Canberra manage aged care? You might say, how do you manage aged care on the ground from offices in Woden? It's a big ask. So how do we go from there to there? A very impressive action by the minister, Mark Butler, was he actually went around and talked to older people and carers about what they thought. And when I asked, should I go along to these, I was politely told, no, we don't want academics, an officialdom like you there. We want older people themselves and carers there. And so when Mark Butler went around, and these are some of the messages he heard directly, and they're there, go read them. They're quite powerful. They want the services when and where they need them. They want the care at home. simplified and streamlined ways to access services. They want to obtain their selected services, and they want as much control as possible over their own death. That's what was written down, not up until death, but at their own death. So really clarifying, what's it for? The Productivity Commission. I will publicly say I think this is one of the best pieces of policy work that I've seen, and particularly in an area as vexed as aged care, and it's long overdue. We have an opportunity now, and to have the articulation, not exact one-to-one, some differences between the PC's recommendations and the government's living longer, living better reforms, and to have some budget follow-up, which was, I think, very valuable. And I and many others would grizzle about some aspects about it. But the basic architecture of this policy development is very solid, very strong. So we have this roadmap ahead, and it's based on extensive consultations, and we hope to have now a beginning of purposeful reform. But this isn't necessarily the right political times to start, but it never is. You get going, and I'm quite hopeful. Okay, now I'm not going to go through in detail the Productivity Commission's report, nor the response from government. Better to get that directly from the sources. But just a few high points through this now. We know the Productivity Commission started off with a problem statement. That's what we do in our policy courses. We say, what is the problem we're addressing? This is it. You can see them all. They come over and over again. But that first one, difficult to navigate the system. And I have heard very skilled social workers who knew the system, strong advocates, lamenting over what they could not find for their mothers. And I expect many of us in this room have had the same experience. Got to make this thing work. Quality, coverage, workforce, regulation. Regulation is a big issue now. How much do you regulate it? What is regulation for? Is it there to improve services, or is it there as a risk mitigation from governments and politicians? It's a good question about regulation. And but at the end of that review, and they had hundreds and hundreds of consultations and submissions, they concluded the system was in need of fundamental reform. So, what did they recommend? It was very valuable to have the joint launch from the minister subsequently on the government's actions to the PC reports. These are the main headline points, and you can see them. Given history, it's not surprising to stay in their own homes, is the first thing said. And the second thing said, as we remember with John Howard's experience back in 1996, that they get to keep their home and not being forced to sell. My father would have approved when he was visiting here. And then the residential care place is increasing, and there are understandable reasons for that. The workforce compact, which I can say I don't fully understand, and we have to work out an understanding of it over the coming months and year. The gateway is a powerful idea to move aged care services ahead. Some comments about standards. And the basic point that we're about 25 years out of date in building a care system, but we have 25 years of development about how to do it right on the ground, often without the support of policy or programs. Okay, this is all pretty obvious. Main thing here is it's going to be staged over 10 years. Basically, the PC recommendations were supported. Problem of the fiscal pressures, and I'll say in particular, it has been a complication, I would say privately, well, publicly now, it's unfortunate that we've had the pressure, the imperative to try to get the budget surplus at the same time as implementing reform. Usually reform has extra dollars in it. There actually are a lot of extra dollars in this reform, but they're deferred. They're deferred at least a year, and a lot of people are worried. New structures, the Implementation Council, Financing Authority. Part of that is about trying to be responsive to have the many of the control parts and the funding parts of the aged care system that are now controlled almost entirely within the Department of Health and Aging. And you people would understand that the spending departments as well as the control departments of Finance and Treasury have a very strong interest in delivering on budget. This is basically saying that we get a little bit of independent separation of the price determination, the funding determination, quality oversight, a little bit separate from the department. And that's going to be a very helpful tension. It's not going to be an easy relationship, and it's one that providers of care are very attentive to, and you can imagine the reasons. And I think it's a very constructive development. It will not be an easy space within which to work. Okay, I'm not going to go through this, but this is one of my colleagues, Carla Heese, went through, and she wrote down what the PC had to say, and then she wrote down some things about the government's response. And the biggest divergence between them, I think, would say these things in red. The Gateway was seen as a major new initiative. At this point, the Gateway is a website and a call center. It may evolve. It should evolve. Okay. Consumer entitlement, we'll go into that a bit later. What came out, increased number but not an increased ratio of home care packages and residential aged care. Big difference there. Contributions, we still have the words user pay, so there must be better words than that. It's really about co-contributions and so forth, and we've got some, I think, sensible measures in there. You'll see the one in red up here, recommendations that were not accepted about selling the family home and putting the resources, other things that are, I think, important and very obvious. And some of the additional things that came from the government, more than, well, an interpretation of the Productivity Commission. The Workforce Compact, and the stated aim is to improve the aged care workforce and to do that through providing additional funding for the workers through organizations that have to sign up and to, you know, put in place enterprise bargaining agreements as to how this is all going to be improved. And quite frankly, I don't fully understand it. There's potential there, and it's going to have to be worked out. Tackling dementia, and what I thought was good, there was a nice balance. Dementia is a huge priority, but there are all sorts of other reasons as well why you need care. You can be confused, you can be vulnerable for all sorts of other reasons. So saying dementia is a really important part of and a rallying cry for aged care, better health connections, including palliative care, an aged care data clearinghouse. I am hopeful that this will be more than an accountancy exercise, part of financial control, and it really will look at the inequalities and what we can do. Importantly, the implementation review 2016-2017, of course the review is going to happen along the way. Is it pointed in the right direction? Are there appropriate resources being devoted to it? Can we learn along the way? But this ongoing learning, accountability, transparency in that process, improvement is going to be crucial. A lot of this is fairly clear. The Council on the Aging, which I'll say had a significant leadership part in developing these new directions, talks about the importance of a wellness framework. Old age is not just about decline and death. It's about staying well and indeed regaining health. Carers are now central to the mix. Quality, transparency, the pricing. Remember I talked earlier about the new financial regulation pricing setting. And the additional comments I put up here I think are important. This is at a National Press Club event. I think it was back in, when was it? I think it's April. There also was talk, a presentation by the Australian Nursing Federation, the main stakeholder in terms of the professions and workers. On the workforce issues, very important. And the Catholic Health Australia, very important influence. Do not gift older Australians a second-rate aged care system. Solution is to legislate aged care entitlements instead of rationing. come back to that. And I would comment that Catholic Health is now recognizing we need an ordered way of enabling people to pay more for their care, which is a position they did not have back in 1996 when the previous reforms foundered. So we're all moving ahead. The good thing is that there's widespread support. NACA, National Aged Care Alliance, very important. I have seen many occasions in the past where a minister could have a meeting where there'd be one interest group saying we should do this, another saying we should do that. And the easy way through, and indeed possibly, certainly the prudent way ahead is to say, you guys sort out what you want, come back to me, and we'll see if we can develop a coherent way ahead. That has happened. The various consumer provider groups are pretty much there together on the main directions. Questions now are about financing and money and the sequencing and so forth. Since the review and the Living Longer, Living Better government actions were laid out, we've had these further recommendations, the urgency for a comprehensive costing study. Are we going to get enough money to do what we're supposed to do? And they want to bring forward some of the changes to be able to charge more. Basically that's what the story is. And that's the current politic, along with what I didn't write up there, because I don't think it's pertinent to the long-run issues. ACFI. Everybody here heard about ACFI? Okay. It's basically a funding instrument. There's a huge political contest now. I expect that a number of people, providers in the electorates, are going to local politicians, to your politicians now, saying something's got to be done about this. Something will be done about it, but what I'll say, it's not central to the longer-term care reforms, while resource adequacy is central to it. And that's all I'm going to say about ACFI, unless you ask me some questions, about which I'll have very few reasonable answers for you. Okay. Where academics can be helpful, it's a longer-term view and what gets done, but the skirmishes along the way, I claim no expertise. Now, here's a very significant a new development. Human rights are fundamental to aged care reform, and the new player is Susan Ryan, Age Discrimination Commissioner. And just to say that going back to the reforms of the mid-80s, the human rights approach was used very powerfully and effectively to focus on who it's for as a kind of counter force, another point of view from a provider point of view. Got those two there in the consumer groups. Very valuable. And this report, please do read it. It's very valuable. Okay. Now, taking stock in some directions. Have any of you heard of Sidney Sachs? A lot of us not. Sid's been gone for a while now. As it turns out, he was my main mentor in aged care when I worked at the Australian National University, and Sid was here, a policy secretariat. We used to get on an airplane and go down to Melbourne frequently together for Council on the Aging meetings. And did I ever get an education? And it didn't come out in the books. But some of Sid's wise sayings, the narrow range, the politically feasible, and recognizing how narrow that range is, especially at critical points like we're in now. A strife of interest, that was the title from one of Sid's books. Lots of interest groups here. A good old age, what's it for? That was the last chapter of one of his books. And then one phrase which really surprised me from Sid. He was the policy mandarin, chief advisor to Malcolm Fraser, negotiating deftly between the different spending and control departments, coming up with a conclusion. It will change when older people hold the money themselves. How's that for a challenge to government direction and accountability? We have these difficulties of implementing reform while trying to hold back expenditure. I must say that and I think many of us, have a real concern for the fiscal outlook, and that's not a political comment. It's not, looking good, it's not a comment just about population aging. One of the references I have there is about our main challenges ahead are not population aging, they're bigger ones. And the biggest risk, again, another bottom line, the risk of under-provision, especially for the economically deprived people, notably those who are not homeowners. Okay, directions. What do older people themselves want? I think we all know these things about they want to continue to be who they are. Tell you what, I'm essentially the same person that I was back in my teens. I expect all of you are, essentially. And that after you retire, and after your health maybe becomes more questionable, you're still going to be the same person. That self-determination is central to drive for independence, to drive for aging in place. The positive goals, even for people who have very significant health problems, they want to feel well, and health is seen as much as a resource. It enables the doing of what one wants to do, indeed who one wants to be. It's not necessarily just a category of expenditure. And this last one, which comes out very powerfully in our research, qualitative research, with older people, you say, well, what's really going on? The feeling that older people are made to feel old, useless, a drain, that ageism, and the powerlessness of it, and the erosion that that causes. That's the starting point from older people. Some of the main points as we look ahead, try to look beyond the immediate policy tussles. Most people stay healthy and independent. For most of it's going to be 2 or 3 decades of later life beyond its current retirement. Community care and support is very well proven to work as we develop further. Most people, when they need care, they will have it in the community. Most people will never enter residential care. That is the mainstay of care. And that residential care, and this is a very tough way of changing our thinking as much as our interest groups, is changing. Increasingly, residential care is no longer like a nursing home, home away from home. It's a place where you need to be physically located there for certain care needs, and for usually limited durations of time, and for things like confusion, usually dementia, but most people with dementia don't need to be in a nursing home, and for end-of-life care. But not all that either. Much of that can be done in the community as well. The basic point is it's about a setting of care for a small group of people. It's a backup to community care. Community care is aged care now. The aim of a good death, and the whole issue about sustainability, which is going to be one of the major ways ahead. And I would say here's a challenge. It's a challenge I tried to explain to my father back in the mid-1980s. I didn't try to explain it to Flo Bjelke Petersen back then, but we need mechanisms to enable people who have the means to fund more of their own care and better care, including use of their estates. Staying in their homes, the spouse can stay, mechanisms for this, the Productivity Commission outlined them. It was politically too hot to touch. And that's why you don't see the words written down. Okay, try to allow some time for questions. So I'll mention some high points about what I see are the main directions ahead. To unbundle accommodation and care. Have any of you heard of that bit of talk? Basically what it says is that what happens now with residential care. You get into residential care, you get an accommodation component, you get your living support, and you get care. It's all bundled up together, isn't it? So what I'll ask my students, who in the room would like a, say, $60,000 a year subsidy? I wouldn't mind it. How about you? Who here is willing to move into a nursing home to get it? That we can provide better choice, better quality, by unbundling and allocating, paying for separately the accommodation and living expenses component. It's more of a welfare principle, and from the care, the needs-based cares with a private contribution. It's more of the health principle. They're quite different. And if we actually separated them, we can fundamentally repackage and mix and have more choice, innovation, and competition. But the problem at present, and it will continue, is If you can't afford accommodation, how can you have community care? One of the starts of all these reforms back in the mid-80s, when it was recognized in very thorough reviews that most people in nursing homes are not noticed, very high proportion were there because they needed accommodation, not because they needed care. And then the next part of this, that notwithstanding some moves to equalize the playing field, we still have accommodation costs and subsidies that are very different across accommodation settings, across the settings of care. Whether they be aspects of residential or aspects of community, we ought to have that in the jargon, horizontal equity and neutral incentives in line with what makes sense. The biggest difficulty with this, I would call it the two hands clapping, the accommodation and the care. The accommodation, we're not doing enough now. Some ideas here, it's still unaddressed. We have some innovative ideas that can develop, they can flourish, they can become part of the mainstream game, but we're not there yet. And there's some ideas here that you can follow up, and it's going to be really important over these next 5 to 10 years in developing this side. Doing care better, we've got some good directions for the PC report and living longer, living better reforms. The cornerstone of the home support program means all those little programs that came in are now being consolidated. And I can tell you where the little programs came in, because they were incremental. Every time a particular higher level community care program came in, they had to be named separately. A minister from the Commonwealth could launch it. It was another fragment, another strand that had to sit along previous strands and so forth. And when I would ask for advice from my friends in government, I would be told, well, Hal, that was the only way to get it through. I'm going back to the 1980s and 1990s. The Commonwealth paid entirely. You couldn't do it together with the states. They wouldn't do it. So we're now going to pull it together again. And that will give us that flexible and focused ways ahead for people with higher and more complex needs. Huge job ahead. One of the hardest ones is, do we open up our approved providers? Who provides most of aged care now? Families. Spouses. I could say older people themselves. Should we pay more for that, one way or another? And what does that do in terms of accountability and incentives? Huge questions. We need to work them through. But important ones not to dodge. This whole theme of enabling independence, it's been a major development of our thinking. How do I put it? We do not just find a deficit in an older person and then fill it with services that an organization is paid to provide and workers are paid to do. We can enable independence, the health promotion part, self-care. And we have good models of how this can be done. They're quite impressive. The active service model in Victoria, I have a reference on that. The home independence model that Jill Lewin has put together at WA, these things have proven they work. And more generally, the research shows that choice and control are very valuable in themselves. We know that in our own lives, don't we? I think this is one of the most important of the initiatives around now. Learning from consumer-directed care trials, it was very wise to put these trials in. The more I looked at it, the more I saw I needed to learn about them. And the more I looked at them, they reminded me of some of the developments that a certain first assistant secretary for HAC placed in the late 1990s for what was called linkages in Victoria at the time, and I was leading an evaluation of those linkages programs, and those linkages programs worked because there was a bucket of money that a care coordinator used to meet needs as the care coordinator, and the older person in care saw was a requirement. It was that flexible. Now, since then, our packages have evolved, haven't they? Fixed budgets, they fix things you can spend on, etc., etc. That's the way of the world. It gets solidified, or you can say more accountable. But we're now coming back to that. The value of a flexible budget with older people and carers. And this next one's quite striking. It can enable older people to manage more on their own. For example, learning and modest equipment investment to clean and cook. It's a huge difference. They can learn to be independent. These programs, if you find the real need and focus resources on that, generate system intelligence. And as we move toward better systems, we're going to have that, I think, from these sorts of studies. And when we say, can we afford these expensive programs? Another way of looking at it is, can we not afford them? When you see that much of the current provision is not the highest priority. Of all the program evaluation virtues or requirements, appropriateness of service, as well as efficiency and equity, appropriateness. And that continuing question, what if the older people had the money themselves? Would we trust them? Is that accountable to the public that pays for it? And in particular, this ACH Adelaide, I want to highlight the value of their work. There's a reference to that. And say, I've learned enough from watching it that I'm actually going to go down there and learn more. Towards regional care and support, in the end, if you're going to have a system that fits together, it has to be in a place where people live. Oops. And this gateway, early days, has the potential to be building comprehensive care systems in a region and in a place. And it's going beyond central control allocations and ticking off the boxes as an application comes in and seeing what really makes sense. The idea of a coherent system, that way supply is the right balance for the place, enabling the system to work in an interrelated way, access, continuity, so on, and strong connections to the local health and community services. That's so important. One hopes that with our new health and hospital networks, along with aged care, developing water region, we can have some more coherency. But that's a big ask. And those connections, and overcome what's now, the way the world is now, fragmentation and ignorance facing consumers and carers. Okay, this idea of entitlements, it's one of the most vexed ideas and one of the most important about where we're going. And the idea of an entitlement, it's like a Social Security or an age pension entitlement. If you meet the criteria, you get the money. It's very different from the ration system we have now. Our health system, largely, not entirely, and certainly our care system, certainly community care, is rationed. And it's all rationed heavily in terms of, from a finance point of view, there are many other aspects, but from a finance point of view, and I've sat on the committees to do this, how to keep people out of the most expensive care setting. State governments spend an awful lot of time trying to save resources in ED. Everybody here knows what ED stands for? Emergency department. That's the pressure point in hospitals for expenditure, for everything. How can we keep them out? Is that the purpose of community care? To keep older people out of ED? From a state point of view, there are all sorts of reasons why that really is important, so I'm not making fun of it. It's really important. But we have to go beyond rationing to say, well, entitlements. And it's so valuable. Talk about a right to care. Human Rights Commission may have something to say about this in the future. But the question is, what if assessed need is far beyond our supply and resources? How do we deal with that? It's a huge challenge for the number one accountability line for the head of the department. How do we limit that? And that's what we have to work out. What it can do in a entitlement approach, we can enable older people's contributions, co-contributions, or their own contributions alongside the government support, the cost effectiveness of providing what people want and need rather than what providers are now being paid to do. Sometimes they're the same, sometimes they're not. And the need to, when this can come in and to work toward it, to build up the care supply that makes sense. How can you give a person an entitlement to something that's not there? And we're building up the care expertise and we have to build up the sustainable funding, a huge challenge. Okay, so how do we aim in these directions? First of all, I think we use some intelligence. My industry is working for a university, and we try to produce knowledge that's useful and translate it. That's part of that second one, but I think the most important one is that policy consistency and implementation. We're at a crucial turning point right now, over these next couple of months, whatever the government, under fiscal pressures, can we keep this wonderful work, although it's flawed in parts and not fully accepted by the government, on track and move it ahead in building caring for older people, not just aged care, but the PC chose caring for older people. That's my part, and I'm going to be part of all this. I'm actually going to be in Canberra as of early next year and be involved. And the question I would like to hear from Parliament is what can and will parliamentarians do? So I think this is the part where I stop talking, apart from listening, answering a few questions, and listen to some of your thoughts on this. Okay, and I would also have further here some acknowledgements, some websites where you can go some more, some further readings, and some further references to how I earn my living, which is the research that we hope is useful. Acknowledgements and so forth. Oops, that's for tomorrow. Okay.
We can preview. But...
I haven't written it all yet. Okay.
Thank you. We do have about 5 minutes for questions, if anyone has any questions. Given how much you traverse to my presentation. Yes, stand back.
There's striking parallels between the aged care sector and, say, disability accommodation services.
Yes.
Now, I might have missed the first couple of minutes, but you only briefly talked about the workforce issues. Now, the lack of investment in training and remuneration in DAS has led to some appalling outcomes. Appalling. I mean, you're talking about 100 investigations for fraud, abuse. It shocked you. Now, you talk also about oversight. Now, without strong oversight, making sure that the legislation aspects are being followed, you're just going to be pumping more money into a sector which has not got the skills to give you the results and client service which you're after. So, I'm interested to see, well, how you're talking about, like, is it SIP 3 for aged care? How in-depth do you think that is, and whether you think it needs to be increased in the order to maybe an advanced diploma stage?
You're spot on with the question. And I'm not going to answer it directly, and you'll see the way I'm not answering it directly. I worked for 7 years as a university manager with 400 staff, with 6,000 students, with a one-line budget for academic leadership and accountability, and with senior managers around me. I could have said, I want to look at everything and approve it. I could have been snowed so easily by everything coming to me, take off the box and the form. I believe that decision-making and accountability and responsibility must be devolved to the appropriate level of knowledge and expertise. So the questions you raise are very important, but they are not going to be addressed by having more forms filled in and an annual quality review. Although those can be important, they're going to be by the devolving of responsibility, ownership, the ways of auditing, consumer involvement, representation, to enable to focus on the important stuff. And in my case, my industry, it was listening to students in part. The whole question about what there is to be learned and related to across the disability and aged care sectors, you saw how I didn't go into disability at all. We have now divided the world up into disability, which is mainly a state responsibility, mainly, and aged care, which is mainly a Commonwealth responsibility. And that's where we are now. There's much that the aged care, caring for older people can learn from the rights approach in disability. So that's my non-answer. What's your answer?
My answer is more investment.
Purposeful investment, isn't it? We have to know what to invest in.
investing, unless you have a focused, motivated workforce which is trying to do an implied service delivery, you're just going to have continued breakdowns. You're still going to have inefficiency. You're not going to have productivity. You're going to have a lack of care and treatment of aged care individuals as often maintenance.
That's so important. The workforce compacts, that's the best take on the potential for them, and that's real and it's important. What I'd also say is that much of how to do it right, we already know. Or a few people know. We have to be able to take that knowledge, disseminate it more widely in the system, and also to enable the direction, policy direction and resources to align with the delivery of that. It's a big challenge. I just don't think it can all be centralized. I think as much as possible, that has to be devolved, carefully monitored, accountable, watch it, guide it, learn across the sector, different places. That's more than 10 years of work. It should have started 5 years ago.
A very interesting talk, and I just wanted to go back to some of those take-home messages that you talked about at the beginning, and one of them was regionally controlled arrangements, and I just, you did elaborate on it a little bit in the talk, but I guess I'd be interested to hear more of your thoughts on what the challenges to implementing that kind of a model might be.
It's a huge challenge. When we look internationally, Australian federalism is basically unique, although there are some parallels with Canada, only some. You compare it to the UK, I'm writing about some work in the UK now. The local authority, by the way, the UK is devolving further in the health area to local authorities for a variety of reasons, some of which we could speculate about, some of which will be good. The problem in Australia is that, in effect, our regional governments now are state governments. And that's a hell of a lot of space to cover for a region. And we have weak responsibility to Commonwealth organizations at a regional level. And we have some glimmers of possibilities ahead with the health networks and the shared funding Commonwealth state. And maybe care for older people could be devolved to regional levels through the one funder, the Commonwealth, more sensibly and can line up better. These are big asks. One of my concerns now is that the state governments, for all their combination of poverty and preoccupation with health, are pulling out of aged care, with the exception of Victoria and Western Australia, because health costs are immense. We've got to focus on our core business. And now, improving things for people with disabilities, younger people, is core business, and some sort of opportunity to move ahead. The regional expertise that we have had has been mainly at a state level, and now it's pulling away, except for Victoria and Western Australia. I don't know much about Western Australia, but I'll be in Victoria tomorrow. I'll be interested to hear whether they're keeping their faith and keeping their jobs. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is interesting that you highlight Victoria and West Australia, and I can't quite see why those two jurisdictions in particular might be able to move forward on this issue, whereas other jurisdictions don't. I'm just curious as to what you think their characteristics are that make them so different.
It's a very good question, and most policy questions, the answer is, well, it started back when.
Yeah.
And in Victoria, there's something called local government. In New South Wales, it's something that has, I'll put it politely, has a very limited range of functions. Local government sees itself as a partner in federalism in Victoria, and in many ways it is. I don't know how they fund it, but they do it. It's a tradition. It's Victorian in all sorts of ways. And they've held on to it. CAC is a co-funded program, most of the intelligence coming from a more local level. Western Australia, I don't understand. I don't know. I'm ignorant. Do you know?
No, perhaps we need constitutional recognition of local government, which I think is on the agenda.
But in relation to WA, they've actually invested a lot in community care, and the state government there has contracted Silver Chain and a number of smaller organisations to provide community care. So it's part of what they do, and that's why it's so successful, because they see it as their business.
Do go back and read the article in the reference to Jill Lewin's work on independence. It's striking. I was shocked to see how effective it is. It's been examined, evaluated, positive outcomes. That was in Western Australia.
And we'll make sure we put all references up on the website so people can do that at their leisure. I think we'll need to close now because we are at the end of time, and I know broadcasting needs to dash away, so they're all ready for parliamentary transmissions. So thank you all for coming, and thank you particularly for what was a very interesting presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
And it's one of the most positive stories.
Seriously.
And
well, I spoke to one of the electric office up on the North Coast, and you know, we have a high percentage of elderly. We're always fielding calls from people about, you know, there's not enough advisors in the area, or, you know, they can't afford to go into a residency. I'm just beginning to get my head around, you know, aged care as it is. It's very, very complex.
It's a problem. But where it doesn't work is a starting point.
They saw the amalgamation as an opportunity to
get that knowledge
get together, otherwise they all would
mentor one, Sydney Sachs, the
start of the regional one.